Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
You're listening to Deconstructive Criticism. I am Aaron Flam. Author and comedian Andrew Doyle has just released 3 of his books in Swedish, Freedom of Speech, Woke, and The New Puritans. He joins me in a conversation about the clusterfuck that is our current state of affairs. Thank you for supporting Deconstructive Criticism. You can contribute on patreon.com/AaronFlam, with PayPal, Bitcoin, and on Swish 0046-768-943737. 0046-768-943737. My own book, This is a Swedish Tiger, about how and why social democracy opened the door for Islamists to the West and their inherent Jew hatred, is available on Kindle. Author, satirist, TV star, and stand-up comedian Andrew Doyle is as sharp with his wit as he is with his pen. I have interviewed Andrew before, when his book Woke, written as the character Titania McGrath, came out. Titania is a woke Twitter troll that satirizes wokeness by being, well, just woke as F. It is hilarious and a much-needed antidote to the strict puritanism of the intersectional left. The New Puritans is a more serious analysis of wokeness written in his own name, and since freedom of speech is the enemy of said left, he had to write a book about that too. All 3 books are now available in Swedish, and I suggest that you buy them and study them. Any and all rhetorical weapons are needed in the fight ahead, and if any country is infected by leftism, it is Sweden. Andrew Doyle is a playwright, journalist, and political satirist from Northern Ireland who has written for the fictional character Jonathan Pye and created the character Titania McGrath. Andrew also has a TV show on GB News titled Free Speech Nation. Enjoy.
Welcome back to Deconstructive Criticism, Andrew Doyle.
Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. And thank you for dinner last night.
It was lovely, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
Nice group of people.
Very.
Yeah, sharing a lot of wrongthink.
Yes, and how long have you been in Sweden now?
2 days.
All right, and how long are you staying?
Another day.
All right.
Yeah, so I won't be able to see much. I won't be able to be much of a tourist.
No.
But although I'm staying in the old town, so the more historical part of town, so I've pretty much seen all the best bits anyway.
Yes, well, yeah. Stockholm is rather small.
Yes.
So you can pretty much walk across it in 40 minutes' time.
Yeah, yeah.
Last time you were here, we talked about your book Woke, written under the pseudonym Titania McGrath, which is now blown, I suppose. People know you are...
I mean, they knew when the book came out because an undercover a journalist had done some sort of investigative work and worked out that it was me. That was for the Times in London.
Hmm.
So actually the week of its release coincided with that story. And so everyone knew, which actually helped the publicity for the book.
I'm sure.
But it wasn't deliberate.
No. Yeah. And at the moment, you're a TV star in England.
Well, I have a show on a new channel called GB News. I have a weekly show where I talk mostly about the culture war. It's a show devoted to that.
Okay, well, then I and now you're in Sweden because all of your books, or at least three of them, have now been translated to Swedish and published.
Yes, so all released simultaneously, which is quite exciting.
Yes, so it's freedom of speech, mm-hmm. of which I understand you're a proponent.
Yes, the book is in favor of freedom of speech.
All right. Well, we are used to controversial views on this show.
Yeah.
So, the new Puritans.
Yes.
Which is about the culture wars that you just mentioned.
That's right. Yeah.
And I was going to start with something else, but we might as well start there. How come you got involved in the culture wars to begin with?
It's a good question. It wasn't deliberate, insofar as, like many people, I was dragged into it, I think, because I suppose my background is stand-up comedy and playwriting and the arts generally. And unfortunately, for whatever reason, the whatever we want to call this, the woke movement or critical social justice or whatever you want to call it.
You want to call it critical social justice.
Yes.
I've read your book. So
I do want to, because I think it's well, maybe we'll get onto that later. But this movement, for whatever reason, has infected the arts particularly. And I would say it has originated from the humanities and from literary studies. And so therefore, it started to have an impact on my life and work. Comedians, I noticed, were policing each other's jokes or complaining about certain topics being joked about. And so freedom of speech, particularly in the UK, I started to see was increasingly under threat, not just from creatives and the industry, but also from critics, from the government even, in various areas, certainly in education. And so I ended up talking about it. And just, I think I wasn't intending to make this my life, but the more I spoke about it, the more ostracized I became, the more angry people, and I didn't understand why, because all I was doing was saying what I felt to be true, which was what everyone believed up until 10 minutes ago. And you kind of, if you're open and honest about your criticisms of this movement, you become siloed, you become a persona non grata, I suppose. And so it just happened. I was sort of pushed into that.
Sounds a lot like my own story, actually.
Yes, yeah.
When I started doing stand-up, I had this principle, because I had all these ideas about comedy, especially stand-up comedy.
Yeah.
And one of my principles was that I was not to do jokes of the difference between men and women, because those are not because it's politically incorrect. I just felt the subject matter was tired.
Yes.
And then a few years in, I noticed that, okay, so now we're in a situation where no male comedians do jokes about women.
Yeah.
But all the female comedians do sexist jokes about men.
Yes.
That seems a bit lopsided.
Yep.
So I think that's...
But then it changed again. But so in the last few years, it's become a taboo to talk about the differences between men and women completely. It's become edgy again, because, of course, so many activists are saying that there are no differences between men and women and that it's all a social construct.
Yes.
And so actually one of the most edgy things you can do is do an old-fashioned joke about the wife or whatever. You know, it's a strange situation.
The old ball and chain.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
The arts, you say, that's where you started noticing it.
I started noticing a tendency towards conformist thinking from those who are ostensibly meant to be the most free-thinking members of society, the creatives. And that, to me, was a fundamental contradiction. I don't think you can be an artist if you are simply trying to gauge what the acceptable point of view is, or indeed if you're using your art as a conduit to express whatever the voguish ideology of the time happens to be. And that is what has happened. I mean, if you go to any theatrical production in the UK now, 9 times out of 10, it will be a sermon disguised as a piece of entertainment. If you go and see a Shakespeare play, it will be simply a means by which the woke ideology can be expressed and supported. It's all about diversity. It's all about sanitizing aspects that are considered problematic. You know, I spoke to the artistic director of an opera company in Wales, and they had done a production of Dead Man Walking, which was a film with Susan Sarandon about a true story about a man who was on death row for a crime that he did in fact commit. And the opera opened with the scene of his crime, which is a rape and murder that he commits. It's quite important that you see that, because the shock of seeing that really raises all kinds of moral quandaries for the audience in terms of the ethics of capital punishment. But they had a discussion, and they sent out a letter to an email to all audience members, everyone who'd bought a ticket, to warn them about the opening scene and to advise that if they might be triggered or upset, they should arrive 10 minutes late so that they wouldn't have to see this upsetting scene. But of course, the upsetting scene is part of the artistic vision. If you don't see it...
Also, they will be disturbing the other audience members if they arrive late.
All sorts of reasons. I hate latecomers anyway. But it struck me that that kind of thing, and similarly with trigger warnings, which are now pretty common in universities. And you might say, well, there's no harm in putting a warning on a work of literature if it will upset certain people. But there actually is a harm, because what it sends a signal. It says effectively that this book is a potential weapon. It's like a grenade. It's like a bomb. It's something that can cause harm and damage. Words, it's that conflation of words and violence, which has seen so many problems in society. So although we might laugh at a trigger warning, like for instance, there was a trigger warning at a university on Julius Caesar that it contained scenes of a murder. Well, if you don't know that already, then you really shouldn't be studying literature in the first place. There was a one on The Old Man and the Sea by Hemingway, and it said that it contained scenes of graphic fishing.
What? Excuse me?
Yeah, you heard me. I just didn't comprehend. No. Because it's so unfathomable. So that, I mean, these things are funny. You know, you see them and they are self-satirizing. They're already funny. But they, like I say, I think they point to something more serious,
yes,
more troubling. And not just the conflation of words and violence, but the infantilization of adults. You know, we forget that we call them kids when they go to university, but they're adults. And they've chosen to study these subjects.
Yes, you mentioned, I think, in the last chapter of your book, The New Puritans, now out in Swedish, I think you mentioned mass infantilization quite at least two times.
Well, I think it's a key problem. I think it's paternalistic. I think it's based on a lack of faith in humanity, a lack of faith in us to make our own decisions. Ultimately, I believe in liberty, individual autonomy, and this movement does not believe in that. It believes that if there are bad words out there, then we, the public, the demos, like drones, will just imbibe these words and enact them and become evil, racist, homophobe, sexists, or whatever, you know, insert epithet there. That I think is fundamentally, it encourages us to be treated like children. And worse than that, you now find students asking to be treated like children. You must protect us from these harmful words. There's that incredible viral video from Yale University, which is easy to find, where a member of staff had written to the students who had complained about Halloween costumes. They'd said there are some really upsetting, triggering Halloween costumes at the party. Can we ban them? And one of the members of staff had written to them all and saying, no, because you're adults and we can't be your parents. And people have to choose to make their own decisions about what they wear and how they react. And there's a viral video of all of the students surrounding this member of staff's husband, who is also a professor, screaming at him, screaming, you are meant to make this a safe space for us. It's not. It's meant to be a home. It's not meant to be.
When was this?
About 3 years ago.
It's interesting. Halloween celebrations have just started to come to Sweden.
Yes.
And the point of Halloween costumes is that they're supposed to be scary/sexy.
Yeah, right. And I think you had some students dressing as Bill Cosby or something like that, or making a joke of the idea of what Halloween traditionally was. And the students were, but the video is shocking because they're screaming and they're swearing at the professor and calling him a motherfucker and all this sort of stuff. And you just think, why aren't they just expelled immediately? Why is this being tolerated?
Why aren't they expelled immediately?
Because partly I suppose it's because the universities are sort of like businesses now, where the students are treated as customers.
Well, I thought you had state-sponsored universities in the UK as well.
Well, this video was from the US.
Right.
But in the UK, we no longer have grant. When I was at the university, I had a full grant because I wasn't from a wealthy family, and so they, you know, you got money. But that stopped the year after I went to university. So increasingly, it's actually harder for people to go to university. They get loans to cover it mostly. But it's not just that. It's also that academic staff are terrified of the students. They're terrified of complaints. You know, I had a friend who taught art history at a university and was told by the faculty that he mustn't show any nude images in his lectures because it might upset certain religious sensibilities. And again,
which religious sensibilities would that be?
It would be Islam.
Yes, it would be. wouldn't it?
Well, yes, and well, but then, you know, there's a history of, if you go back long enough, at the Vatican, there was a time where they were chopping off all the penises of the statues, which is why when you go around the Vatican now, you can see a lot of them have been glued back on, which I find quite funny because there must have been a box of these penises somewhere in the Vatican vaults for many years. But, you know, obviously things have changed in Christianity and Christendom generally, if you want to use that old-fashioned term. But in Islam, clearly, this is a sensitivity. And my friend who was teaching art history did try to make the case that if you can't show nude bodies, you can't really teach art history, particularly Western art.
No.
It sort of immiserates the entire discipline, and it can't really be done. But he had to do it, otherwise he would have lost his job. So there's all those various, you know, universities are meant to be about knowledge, the pursuit of truth, etc. Now they seem to be largely factories for laundering ideological ideas or propagating those ideas. And that to me is just the opposite of what they're meant to be for.
Yes, same here, but we have, you know, state-funded universities,
right,
and higher learning institutions.
Yes.
Here it's probably been going on for a much longer time.
Yeah.
But you write in the last chapter of your book about mass infantilization that it's a failure of socialization, right? These young people haven't been socialized into society properly. So are you blaming just the parents then?
No, I think it's cultural trends more broadly. I think I make the case that in order to be an autonomous adult, you have to be effectively socialized in childhood.
But that would be the parents' responsibility.
That's partly that. Yeah, absolutely. But also schooling. I think I've probably become more old-fashioned. I've grown to realize that the system of education that I went through was actually didn't serve me well. And I'm continually catching up on my own education by reading. But we didn't study Latin or Greek. We didn't study the classics. We were taught books that were not particularly challenging.
And when was this?
Well, that was in the 80s and 90s.
Right.
So late 80s and 90s. And I feel that my parents' generation had a much better education than I did. And we had very little in the way of discipline in the way that they did. So I think my ideas about education have changed. And I suppose that's the case I'm trying to make in the book. That because a lot of people will try to say that my stance on free speech, for instance, doesn't apply when it comes to children. But I know it doesn't apply when it comes to children because I think children need boundaries and discipline, and et cetera. And the reason I want to enforce that so much is because I wholeheartedly believe in liberty for adults. We should be able to make our own decisions about our own lives. And that's something I will always stand by. But I think that that's harder when you haven't really grown up, when society hasn't let you grow up.
Obviously. But that's, I mean, it's a failure of parents. But as you said, if university administration takes part of this in this infantilization, then society becomes culpable, I suppose.
Well, it's not just that. I mean, it's culture. I mean, to give you an example.
Culture consists of individuals.
It does. I suppose what I mean by culture specifically, let's take the arts. If I want to read a work of fiction, I will always choose a book that was published before I was born, because that way I know its quality will at least be reasonably high. Now, that suggests something to me, as in books were just better written 60 years ago than they are now. If you take a P.G. Wodehouse novel, which was considered light entertainment, light novel that teenagers would read, adults as well, but, you know, it was not considered heavy going. But if you try and summarize the plot of a Wodehouse novel, they are incredibly complex as farces. It's very difficult to do.
Really?
Yeah.
I mean, basically, Wooster and Jeeves goes to a summer estate of some well-to-do that they know or are related to.
Yeah.
Because one or several of Wooster's aunts wants him to marry the heiress.
Yes.
While the heiress, of course, is involved with one of Wooster's friends.
Yes.
And another one of Wooster's friends is in love with the heiress.
Yes.
Yes. Whilst the heiress's friends, who's also at the castle for summer, is in love with the friend that's in love with the heiress. Is that so complicated?
It actually is. I mean, that what you're describing is more like one of his short stories.
All right.
If you actually read one of the novels, I actually wrote down...
I've read all of them.
Well, I wrote down the plot for Uncle Fred in the Springtime, and I started writing about those sorts of misdirections and everything.
Yes.
And it became this sprawling, mass kind of mess on this page because there were too many different interconnected strands. Which, of course, is how Fast works. It should be the point in Fast that you actually get confused yourself while you're reading it. That's sort of how it should work. And it's not something that he's just rushed off.
No, no.
And the right,
but he did write quite a few of them.
I wrote over 100 books. And the prose style is incredible. There is no one who can write like that even now. You know, the stylistic is just brilliant. It's literary, and yet they consider that just sort of the equivalent of an airport paperback.
But by now he must be cancelled. After all, he was in Germany during the war.
Right. Well, there are a couple of things there. I mean, the firstly to the point: if you pick up a cheap paperback from an airport now, it'll be like it's like a child's book now, comparatively. So that's my point about the degradation generally. Woodhouse has had to be rewritten. In fact, the new editions of his books are now, they've taken stuff out.
Really?
And they've rewritten phrases that are considered offensive. Mostly phrases that to do with either racial depictions or even weight. If someone is overweight, there's bits have taken out because that might upset people.
Fatphobic,
exactly. Yes. So yeah, that has happened. Caused a bit of an uproar though, which is quite reassuring. So people weren't happy about that. And also, yeah, he stayed behind in France when the Germans invaded. And then while he was imprisoned, did some ill-advised radio broadcasts for the Nazis. But it was more to do with his temperament. You know, the idea that he was a collaborator is preposterous and has been debunked a million times.
I know.
And, you know, what's his character? He satirized Mosley's black shirts in one of his novels. I can't remember the name of the character, but it's so caustic and brilliant.
I think that character returns in several
novels. Yes, he does. Yes. And you know, a Nazi collaborator doesn't do that. You know, so
it's about shorts. He wants to the British men's knees.
All
British men's knees must be visible for everyone at all times.
Exactly. Yes. Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. And also something about potatoes or spuds.
I don't recall, but I'll take your word for it.
Hmm. generally, how are things in England post-Brexit?
Brexit drove England mad in a way that I don't think other people from other countries fully appreciate. I think you have to be in the midst of that storm to realise. It was the largest mandate in our democratic history. More people voted in that vote than any other that has ever occurred. We had months and months and months of debate where everyone was participating. And there was something quite exciting about that because there's a general apathy when it comes to politics in large segments of the population. And for this, that didn't appear to be the case. People were debating in the pub, you know, with their friends, on the football pitch, at the bus stop, everywhere. You know, these things were going. It was on the TV all the time. And yet, in spite of that, once the vote came in, members of the commentariat and the political class decided that no one knew what they were voting for and tried to undermine it. We had a parliament attempting to undermine the vote, either to get them to re-vote, as was Labour's policy, or to just have it completely stymied entirely, as was the Liberal Democrats' policy. Nick Clegg, who was the leader of the party at the time, wrote a book called How to Stop Brexit, which may as well have been called How to Stop Democracy, as far as I can see. And people just continually saying that it wasn't a legitimate vote because no one understood what they were voting for. But on the contrary, they understood more about this than any other vote they'd ever taken because we had those debates and we had those arguments. So it was quite astonishing. And this goes back to the infantilism idea, this idea that nobody really had agency.
Yeah.
You know, I suppose it goes back to the... They lack the awareness, the consciousness, I suppose you'd say.
Because you were pro-Brexit.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
And why?
Or?
Why did you dump us?
It was very much specifically aimed at Sweden.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm just sick of it. Sick of the Swedes. No, the reason, well, my background is very much on the left economically. And I don't think it is consistent to espouse left-wing views while you are voting in favour of a pro-corporate, neoliberal, unbureaucratic, technocratic body, a trading bloc that has capitalism at the heart of its constitution. I think that's an incoherent stance. I found it bizarre that all of my left-wing friends in the UK became sudden enthusiasts for the EU overnight, having never expressed any sentiments regarding them before, having no understanding of how the Commission works or what it does, painting their faces in the EU flag colours, the incredible zealotry based on no knowledge whatsoever. These same people who had demonised the likes of Margaret Thatcher, but were quite happy to cheer on the likes of Michel Barnier and Donald Tusk and Guy Verhofstadt and these various right-wing politicians in Brussels. It was hilarious to me, you know, and I thought it was a nonsense. And I thought, ultimately, if I were to give a reason in a nutshell, it was about democracy. It was, why are we outsourcing democratic power to unelected bureaucrats? Why would we do that? You know, Tony Benn used to have his five famous questions, which I think I might quote in the book, about politicians. The last question is, how do we get rid of you? For any democracy to work, the power has to be with the demos. If people are making decisions, changing our laws, and we can't vote them out, we no longer live in a democracy, which is why I believed that the EU had to be got rid of. And I stand by it. I think even if we were left in economic ruin, it would still be the right decision, just on the principle of democracy.
So how come do you think that wokeism has taken over so much of the Anglo world? I'm talking United States, Canada, Australia, New Zealand.
It's interesting, but well, Peter Boghossian has a theory about this, that it is to do with the language, that woke ideas don't translate particularly well.
To what?
To any other language.
He's absolutely wrong, but
that's what I, yes, yes, that's his argument. However, I do notice, I mean, the Titania McGrath book has been translated into, I think, 10 languages now, and only one of them translates the title. The word woke is retained for all of the others. And there are, I mean, his view is that if you, the ideas don't translate, but you're saying that clearly isn't the case in Sweden.
No. Personally, I think if you ask me the same question I just asked you, I think that it's so noticeable in the Anglo world because you're so individualistic and you're not used to conformist and consensus-seeking ideas. What you call woke is just what we in Sweden for decades, 100 years, have called consensus culture. And it's a form of collective, it's an expression of collectivism.
But then when I speak to Spanish people, they say this is a relatively new thing in their country. The woke movement is very much gripping onto Spain now, but it wasn't there.
No, but it would be very hard in Latin languages that actually separate the genders grammatically.
Yeah. Or quite. Yeah, I don't know, but it has certainly taken off certainly Canada is basically lost at this point.
Yes.
Australia is really bad. New Zealand's a joke. UK, obviously, America. Yeah, I mean, there's something about the language that does, and there must be some reason why it takes hold in the Anglosphere.
Well, I think it's just more noticeable when it comes for you guys because you actually mobilize a resistance to it instead of just, you know, calmly accepting it. And
well, you know, there's something in that. And I also do feel that although, you know, they call the UK TERF Island, which is TERF, Trans-Exclusionary Radical Feminist, which is just a synonym for witch, basically. But they call it TERF Island because there is a real fight back against gender identity ideology in the UK, which hasn't occurred anywhere else, really, not to this extent. And I think it will be the hub of a global change because it is an the ideology in of itself is a nonsense. It is a belief system that is just, that depends upon the negation of reality. So once someone starts speaking up about it, once someone points at the emperor and says he's naked, everyone else has permission to laugh. And I think that's what's happening in the UK, that we're saying, no, there are two sexes. No human being has ever changed sex. We don't have a mysterious gendered soul that may or may not be allied with our anatomy. That thing is not true. Or that same-sex attracted young people ought to be medically fixed so that they fit into a heterosexual paradigm in the name of progress. This is not something that any sort of rational person can believe. People have, though, for the past 10 years or so, for 5-10 years. But there's a real fight back in the UK, and it's working. And that's really
reassuring.
I think so. Yeah, absolutely. You know, the Conservative government were trying to push through reforms to the Gender Recognition Act to effectively mean that anyone can claim to be the opposite sex and have their birth certificate changed with very little in the way of a medical diagnosis, which is what Scotland were trying to do. And as they were trying to push that through, which Westminster actually overruled, but as the Scottish government, coincidentally, as they were pushing it through, there was a very high-profile case of a man called Adam Graham, double rapist, who decided after he was arrested for rape to identify as Isla Bryson, a woman and start wearing a terrible wig. And they were going to house him in a female prison. In fact, they were accommodating him in a female prison until they'd made their risk assessment decision. And this all became news at the same time as the Scottish government's vote to basically make anyone could identify as the opposite sex within a matter of months just by saying so. And then they had to back down. I think it brought down Nicola Sturgeon, who was the head of the SNP.
And because he couldn't reply to the simple question, what a woman is.
Right, exactly. And whereas, you know, I mean, even, what's her name, Jackson, the nominee for the Supreme Court, when she was quizzed about this, what is a woman? And she said, I can't answer that. I'm not a biologist. Even though any four-year-old can answer it without a degree in biology. More and more people are waking up to the point that it's very funny to watch politicians struggle to answer the most basic of questions. Keir Starmer was asked on a radio show. He's the leader of the opposition in the UK. And he was asked, can a woman have a penis? And he just stammered and stuttered and panicked. And that's funny. And the reason it's funny is we all know that he knows the answer. And he knows that we all know that he knows the answer, but he still can't say the answer. So it's almost like the Basil Fawlty thing. It's funny when Basil Fawlty is angry, but he isn't able to express it because he's talking to a posh person or a lord or something.
Yeah.
So similarly, he knew the answer and we knew, but he couldn't express it. And that's funny. It's a restrained emotion. And it's, you know, it makes him a laughingstock. So now he's had to change his mind. I think he's now saying that 99% of women don't have penises. But even 1% of women having penises is still a lot of penises.
For women.
And isn't true, more to the point. Whereas Rishi Sunak has come out and said, women don't have penises. It's weird that this is even a discussion.
Yeah, I know. You can imagine, I had stayed away from the topic as a comedian my entire career.
Yeah.
And then suddenly I sort of find myself doing a comedy special called Groin, where I basically have to say, men have penises and women have vaginas.
Yeah.
Can we all agree on that? If you think that gender is just a social construct, you've never got a kick to your social construct.
Yes.
Yes.
I mean, that's very funny. There's a child in Kindergarten Cop, the Arnold Schwarzenegger film.
Yeah, I remember.
He's about 5 years old and he stands up and says, boys have a penis, girls have a vagina. And even he knew. Now he would be arrested for a transphobic hate crime. But it's insane. But the sheer insanity of it is changing. I mean, I think the tipping point very much, firstly, it's the rapist in female prisons. People like Karen White, I don't know what his real name is, but, you know, rapist, paedophile, identifies as a woman, is moved into a female prison and goes on to sexually assault women in that prison. I mean, it actually happens. But I think this went on for a long time because if you tell the average person on the street, by the way, there are male rapists in women's prisons, they won't believe you. They'll think that's just too preposterous. But it actually is happening. There are rapists in female prisons in Ireland at the moment. And it's so absurd.
So Ireland is also on the...
Ireland's worse than England. Ireland is... because they were, for so many years, they were obviously beholden to the Catholic Church. And they've got rid of that. And they voted again. They voted for same-sex marriage and for abortion rights. And they've gone all the other way. And they've just found a new religion to sort of occupy the hole that is left by Catholicism. And they've gone full on. I mean, Ireland at the moment is instigating some major draconian hate speech legislation, which is even worse, I think, than Scottish hate speech legislation. And that is saying something.
So that's, I'm glad you brought up Ireland for several reasons, but I think you just said it and sort of summarized your book, The New Puritans, in the process, which is they got rid of Catholicism, an old religion, and now neo-heathenism, hedonism, heathenism.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that how you would view the woke sectarians as a form of neo-heathens?
Are they heathens?
Well, they believe it's a moral relativism.
Yes.
So that is heathen.
Yes.
I'm sure if we cram in Greta and Sam Smith, we can probably construct some sort of, what would you call it? The Greek word is not Parthenon, but something like that, like a collection of gods.
That's Parthenon.
Right.
Oh, no, wait, no, sorry.
No?
No, it's not.
It's something
it's
else.
It's Pantheon.
Pantheon, there you go.
Because Parthenon is to do with the virgins.
Oh, right.
is the Temple of the Virgins, yes, in Greek.
My mind must have been somewhere else.
Yeah. Pantheon is all the gods, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So can you, I mean, I just did this out of the top of my head, Greta and Sam Smith, but because you were one of the first to actually classify wokeism as a religion, right? You must have been very early out.
I was very early, but I wasn't the first.
No.
But I was early in it. I've been characterizing it as such for about eight years or so. But I know that others had done so beforehand, because it does share all the hallmarks of some kind of religion, insofar as it punishes heretics, seeks out heresy. It has a form of excommunication, which we now call cancel culture. But for a while, we didn't have a name for it. And it believes in ultimately unfalsifiable, it makes unfalsifiable claims. It, you know, the gendered soul idea is a perfect example. Structural racism, this sort of nebulous spirit stuff that goes on.
Yes. So, have you heard about xenopronouns?
Well, I know of neopronouns.
No, these are xeno.
I don't know about xenopronouns.
They are unspeakable.
Right, okay.
It's someone whose pronouns are so esoteric that they cannot be mentioned.
Fascinating.
Yes.
Absolute nonsense. But I mean, there are some whose pronouns are now cat and cat self. And of course, you shouldn't be indulging how these are children, like I say. You don't indulge a toddler. You tell it to shut up, you know, but we're just indulging it. So yeah, absolutely. So yes, I've definitely seen from an early stage the religious overtones to this. And but also it's not just a religion, it's an intolerant fundamentalist religion. As to whether it is essentially heathen, it's certainly Philistine. It certainly hates the arts. The arts for this movement are simply a means to propagandize. If it doesn't support the cause, it has no other purpose. Whenever an ideology infects any institution, that institution then becomes solely about the promotion of the ideology and not about its original function, hence the universities, which are no longer about the pursuit of truth. It is about the promotion of this. Similarly, even in the NHS or the police or whatever, schools, you know, so all of these libraries particularly, I mean, there are librarians who are hiding books if they consider them to be problematic or not stocking them at all. There's a real weird problem with wokeism in libraries, in librarians. The British Library in London has a decolonizing working group that decided to create a watch list of authors who had connections with the slave trade so that they could keep an eye on these problematic authors. The group even decided that the shape of the library was a problem because it resembled a battleship and was therefore militaristic and colonial. So these people are insane and just very, very stupid, I think, a lot of them. I can't remember what the question was.
It doesn't really matter, I think. We're heading somewhere. We're recording this on the 25th of October, 2023. It's almost 3 weeks after Hamas's terror pogroms against Israeli Jews. How many British artists have signed lists in support of Israel?
There were 2,000.
Sorry. In support of Israel?
No, the opposite. The opposite. 2,000 in support of Palestine.
Oh, right. That would make way more sense.
Yeah, that happened last week. Steve Coogan was one of the lead signatories.
Of course he was.
I signed a declaration in support of British Jews a few days later.
You and how many others?
About 100.
Oh, right.
150, something like that. It's
more than I thought.
Yeah, yeah. So I think there was a... what was shocking about, you know, that statement by Coogan, etc. There was some kind of nod to, we don't support killing of civilians. That was sort of a little nod there. But there was no outright denunciation of Hamas.
And civilians, it could be Palestinian civilians, yeah, it could be Israeli civilians.
It was very, you know, mealy-mouthed. And anyone who is supportive of Palestinians and Palestinian civilians' right to life, which they do have, of course, should denounce Hamas first and foremost, because Hamas are the ones that are putting them in danger, not just by committing atrocities against Israel and therefore it guaranteeing a reaction, a military reaction, but also literally using them as human shields, having their headquarters in hospitals, in places where civilians must gather and cannot leave. Hamas doesn't care about the people of Palestine. It sees them as collateral damage in its greater, broader plan, which is outlined explicitly in its charter of wiping Israel off the map.
Yes.
So if I don't believe people when they say they are pro-Palestine who do not denounce Hamas, I don't think that's coherent.
Well, can't you believe that they really hate the Jews?
I can believe that.
All
exactly.
Right. Well, there you go.
Well, so there
That's
we go.
That's what they're trying to tell you.
Yes. Well, so this is it. I mean, I've spoken to people who are activists who support Palestine, etc., who do denounce Hamas, but they don't do it at these gatherings. You know, that's what I'd like to say. You know, any commentator that you see on TV usually starts with, of course, I denounce the atrocities against the Israeli people, you know, what happened the other week. But they don't do it at these gatherings. That's the test. I think when 100,000 people marched in London for Palestine and there were people speaking on these platforms, I would have liked to have seen people there say, first, we denounce Hamas and everything that they've done. And they didn't.
No.
And they should have.
Yes.
And that would have alleviated my concerns about the anti-Semitism within that movement. It would have, but you see, had they done so, can you imagine what the reaction of that crowd would have been?
Yes, they would have been killed.
Right.
So you told me last night that the Metropolitan Police, yep, the Met, as you call them.
Yeah.
I just want to say the entire phrase for my Swedish audience in case they don't understand what the Met is.
And they should know that the Metropolitan Police, they are in London. They're
yes.
The London Police, yes. Yes,
yes. That's where the word metropolitan, yes.
Yeah, but there are other cities in the UK. And
yes, people of course there are.
Might not have understood.
But you told me anyway that they had not reacted against people brandishing, was it Hamas flags?
Yeah, there was, not a Hamas flag.
Calls for jihad.
There was a guy with a flag that was, I believe, the Al-Qaeda flag.
Okay.
Not much better.
No, definitely not.
And he was screaming about a curse on the Jews, I think he was screaming. It's quite explicit.
Yes.
But he was eventually arrested, only after a social media outcry.
Because they do arrest people for brandishing like British flags or English flags.
Yes, they have done. They've arrested, it depends on the context, I think. I haven't seen them arrest people for brandishing British flags. But I saw someone, a police officer, escorting a man away for brandishing an Israeli flag, although they would claim it was probably for his own safety, I suppose. But they do arrest people for misgendering. That's happened. People have been arrested for calling a man a man because he identifies as a woman. They've also arrested people and investigated people for mean tweets. Someone has served prison. People have served prison time for jokes, for distasteful jokes. So if there is a hate speech law, it is not applied consistently. Let's put it that way. If you can stand on the streets and scream a curse on the Jews or call for jihad and you're not arrested, then there's something inconsistent at least about that. The other example was the members of a group called Hizb ut-Tahrir, which is a militant Islamist group.
We have them here as well.
Right. But they're banned in most Arab countries.
Of course they are.
Because they're not good news. And they were calling for jihad. And then the Met Police put out a statement saying, yes, but jihad means lots of different things. It can mean an internal struggle, a struggle to exempt yourself from sin. But this guy was screaming for jihad through armies that would march on the forces of Israel.
Yes.
The context couldn't have been clearer. And the Met Police were lying to us about their reasons for not taking action.
And why do you think they are lying?
Fear, I should imagine. For the same reason why they didn't investigate the rape of children in Rotherham and in the various northern towns.
By Pakistani rape gangs.
Yes. And they admitted it was because of they didn't want to stir up racial tension or be accused of racism. So that's now confirmed. That's not me speculating. That is the fact. So they were prioritizing identity politics and race relations over the rape of children. Well, I think if you're doing that, your moral compass is kind of skewed.
Yes, and then what are a few Jews on top of raped children?
Well, quite.
Yes.
And is it not the case that there is also a soft form of racism against British Muslims here? It's implying that they shouldn't be subject to the same law as everyone else because they can't handle it, because they're like children, because they're bound to react violently. Well, there's the majority of British Muslims don't behave like that and don't support rape. So why treat them like this? You know, apply the law and arrest these people. That's what I would say.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
I don't really understand Britain, I must admit, even though I was an ardent Anglophile in my tweens before I actually went to England.
Yes.
Because I had gotten to know England through the books of P.G. Woodhouse.
I
loved England.
Yeah, but that never really existed. The books, you know.
Yes.
He was creating a kind of fantasy.
And the five books and Bill, that mischievous child, Bill books.
Oh, Just William.
Yes, I had all of them. I read them all.
Ah, okay.
I love them.
I read some of them as a child. I loved them as well. Yes. Yeah.
So, I can't really square it because England fought the Nazis.
Yes.
Yes. And England issued the Balfour Declaration in 1917, which is sort of the basis of the modern state of Israel.
Of course.
Because it was Palestine was a British mandate.
Yep.
It wasn't a Palestinian state. It was a British, well, protectorate or something.
Yeah.
Where does the British either anti-Semitism or because the BBC refuses to call Hamas terrorists,
it
wants
odd.
To call them militants, for me that's anti-Semitism or at least indifference to anti-Semitism.
I think the BBC have just changed their mind about that and they've said they will now describe Hamas as a group that has been proscribed as a terrorist group by the UK government. Bit of a mouthful.
Well,
but at least it's closer to the, at least it is the
good
truth.
Good for them.
Yeah. I think once people are massacring kids at a music festival and burning children alive, I think if you don't call them a terrorist, then you're lying. I think at that point, you know. So the BBC have a lot to answer for. But the question is why. I don't think it can be all put down to anti-Semitism. I think it is, there's something about this movement, which people call leftist, but I don't even think it's leftist. And for whatever reason, Jewish people are low down on the on their hierarchy of grievances. And I think it's because they see them as privileged, I think. I think that's, they see them as white, even though the majority of people in Israel are not white.
But I mean, you come from economically disadvantaged conditions.
Yes.
So you come from the left. Is
well,
that
I
a
always
fair
said that.
Assumption?
Well, yeah, but I don't, I now think left and right doesn't mean anything anymore. I don't even describe myself like
well,
that.
Well, if I put forward the idea that the left is driven by the mortal sin of envy, what would you respond?
Well, it never... I don't know whether that's what drives people. I wouldn't like to assume. I think the ideal in the beginning was about economic equality, was it not? Or at least redressing extreme economic inequality. I always saw socialism as a corrective to the excesses of capitalism in the way that someone like Schumpeter advanced. The idea that no one needs to be a multi-billionaire. You know, you can redistribute wealth to a degree, not to completely eliminate the notion of ambition or that you know, you can't earn a lot and have what you want, but that the excesses could be curbed. And that's the way I sort of saw it. I mean, I earn a lot more now than I used to, and I'm happy to be taxed at the top rate.
Really?
Yeah, because I think I earn more and that's fine.
Yes, but your taxes goes to, you know, the universities that promote woke ideology and it goes to the Metropolitan Police who can't arrest someone who's calling for jihad. Yeah. It goes to the BBC who obviously can't tell you the truth.
Well, the license fee goes to the BBC, which I do pay.
But yes, but the license fee is sort of mandatory, is it,
it
not?
It is. Yeah, yes, that's
so,
right. That's right.
That
but there are lots of things. There are lots of things that my taxes go to that I do approve of. Sanitation, people collecting bins, hospitals. Even the NHS is captured, but they still do a lot of good. I'm not one of those that thinks that simply because a lot of the government spends the taxes in a way that I don't necessarily approve of means that it's a bad idea. I don't begrudge it. I think society needs to operate.
So do I.
I'm not...
But I also want it to operate well.
I'm not a libertarian. I don't think that taxation is theft. I think it's, you know, but so I, in that respect, I think, I don't know if that's, I don't see how that's envy. I think.
Well, if you have less and someone else has more.
Yeah.
And you want some, that someone's more.
That's envy.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And envy tends to drive you insane.
But I've never been a communist. I've never said everyone should have exactly the same.
No, but yes. Well, I'm not from the left, even though I grew up in a home where my father was Social Democrat,
yes,
or yeah, Labour, as you'd call it.
Yeah.
But I've just always had it, because if you ban them all together, and before we come to that, I wanted to talk to you because I tried to get you to answer where the anti-Semitism comes from in England.
But I couldn't possibly say any more than I could say where racism comes from, where extreme homophobia comes from. I think, well, I'll tell you where I think it comes from human beings. I think there is always going to be an element within humanity which is hateful, doesn't like difference, and that will manifest in various ways. And I don't think that is defeatable. I think the only solution to that is what I call social liberalism, civilization, is that we build up a civilized world so that such things are become marginalized, which is where we were heading and doing pretty well, you know?
Until
wokeism, which resurrected it. So, you know, the critical race theorists, for instance, have always said liberalism is the enemy because there is still racism. We have all these laws that say that everyone's got to be treated equally, and yet racism still lingers in society. That proves that liberalism has failed, which is a misunderstanding of liberalism, because liberalism is aware that it is we are trying to make the best of an imperfectible world. It is an ongoing project. That's the misunderstanding there. And liberalism has its successes, which are quite palpable. To live as a black man in the 1960s in America is not the same experience as living as a black man in the 2020s in America. And that's because of the success of social liberalism. And the woke movement and critical race theorists will say that, no, they are utopians in a way, or dystopians, really, that they can produce, if they can control the words that people say, and they can control the institutions, racism will be eradicated. And I don't think it will be. Anti-Semitism is called one of the world's oldest hatred.
Yes.
I don't think you will eliminate it. But what I think you can do is build up in a society, a civilized society, in which those that have anti-Semitic views know to keep them to themselves and don't have any, it has no clout, it has no currency. That's how we deal with it. So where it comes from on the left, I don't know. I imagine there is a strong correlation between Israel and that overlap when it becomes criticism of the Israeli government to criticism of Jews is always there. I don't think, by the way, that criticism of the Israeli government is automatically anti-Semitic, but I think
neither do I.
I think there can be an overlap.
Israelis do it all the time.
They do, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So I think they're...
But anti-Zionism is wanting to eradicate the Jewish state.
Yes, although some people who call themselves anti-Zionists say they don't mean that. They mean that they are against the set further settlements on the West Bank and that kind of thing.
Well, by now I think the burden of proof rests on them.
Yeah, sure.
But anti-Semitism, I think, is a kind of envy.
That makes sense.
And I don't think it has been resurrected entirely by the woke. It's also been resurrected through mass immigration.
Yeah.
Which is a leftist policy.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then the pro-Palestinian stance in the West is a leftist policy. Gender theory, leftist policy, right? Race theory, leftist policy. Climate hysteria,
yeah,
leftist policy.
Or wouldn't it be better to say policies that are held by those who consider themselves leftists?
Yes.
Because I don't think they are authentically left-wing positions, insofar as all of these things have been substitutes for money, class, the traditional aims of Marxists.
Yes, but in a way, I mean, the left lost the economic argument in 1989, 1990. And then culture was all that was left. And
I mean, that's exactly the time at which you had the postmodernists applying their theories to society.
Yeah.
The applied turn, 1989, where suddenly, because the postmodernists were happy to theorize, they never expected public policy to change until then. And then there was an active effort by activist academics to see praxis of their ideas, to see things applied. So that's coincidental. Or
so,
maybe not.
So what is your recipe to get rid or not get rid of them, but to sort of lessen the impact of the generations of young people all over the West, because these ideas have been espoused at universities here too.
Yeah.
When I studied film science back in the late 90s, or film studies as you call it, it's gender science here, it's not gender theory.
And I bet it's not scientific at all.
It is pretty much the same, I suspect, that you, I mean, it's Judith Butler, and we have some Swedish theorists that you've probably never heard of, but they're inspired by Shulamit Firestone and people of her ilk. So, what is your recipe to sort of save the West, basically?
I don't have the answers, or at least if I do have the answers, they're not my answers. What I do in the books that are now you've got in front of you is advance the cause of social liberalism, because I think it is the best way to deal with these problems and has a proven track record of dealing with these problems. The other thing I think we could be doing is exposing these theories that are now dominating society for what they are, expose how ineffective they are on the face of it, how they achieve the opposite of what they claim to achieve. You know, critical race theory claims to want to eradicate racism whilst making us a more racist and racially divided society. Gender theory, LGBTQIA+ advocacy claims to be looking out for gay people whilst mutilating gay children, heterosexualizing them through surgery, preventing gay people from gathering, and generally regressing gay rights by about 3 decades. So I think alerting people to the fact that these movements are in fact regressive but describe themselves as progressive, are illiberal but describe themselves as liberal. In other words, that they are, how would you put it? They are engaged in linguistic prestidigitation. They are just simply...
Linguistic?
Prestidigitation, a sleight of hand.
Oh, right. What?
when you sleight of hand, what a magician does.
I know sleight of hand. Just never heard that word. I love new words.
Ah, well, that is how I would describe it, because it's basically word games.
Yeah.
That is also probably the key to their success, because everyone wants to see themselves as fair and liberal and progressive. Those three words, diversity, equity, inclusion, mean the opposite of what they seem to mean. People think that equity means equality. It means the opposite. People think when they talk about inclusion, it means inclusion. It doesn't. It means exclusion of ideas they don't approve of, etc. So breaking through the linguistic minefield, that's what I'm really trying to do in the book. The New Puritans is spend so much time on the language, what they say they mean and what they're actually saying.
Anti-fascist, anti-racist.
Exactly, exactly. Which people think, if you hear anti-racist, do you think that's great? Because I don't like racism, therefore I'm on their side. Not realizing that you're supporting the very thing you should be opposing. Because anti-racism doesn't mean anti-racism in the traditional sense. It means being proactive in the discovery of racism, which means that and that you have to be particularly qualified to detect the nebulous racist structures that exist in society. And you have to accept that all white people are racist and complicit in white supremacy, even if they're not. That there is no such thing as a dichotomy of racist and not racist. As Ibram X. Kendi says, to be not racist is a form of racism. You know, so it's a minefield. But once you've understood the games that they play, then you can demolish them quite easily. That people are frightened of the jargon. I think that's it. Critical race theorists spend a lot of time talking about how complex, you know, that if you see the arguments on Twitter, they'll often say, well, you don't understand this. I've got a degree in critical race theory. You don't understand this. It's too complicated for you. Just accept what I say. But actually, it's dead simple.
Yeah.
And anyone can work that. You could read. There's a book by Richard Delgado and Jean Stefancic, a married couple who wrote Critical Race Theory, An Introduction, aimed at teenagers. It's very short. It outlines explicitly what critical race theory is all about from a critical race theorist's perspective. And you read that and you know what it is. And you know that it's illiberal and terrible for society. And so it's not difficult for people, but they just have to make the effort to understand it. And just exposing the inconsistency of it. You know, the gender theories, the idea that we have this innate gendered essence, which is fixed, so you have to change your body, and fluid at the same time, and can change every day. There's no consistency here.
Well, I think the consistency is that if you are cis, then gender does not exist. But if you're trans, it definitely exists. No, but you're in the wrong one.
But they don't say that. They say that if you are cis, which is a word they use and I don't, if you are cis, you do have a gender identity, you just don't know that you do. Which is like a priest saying you do have a soul, whether you deny it or not. Yeah. They say everyone has a gender identity. And yet, Judith Butler says you don't. And Judith Butler's their high priestess. I mean, she says there is no gender identity. There are kind of, the gender is a kind of performative reenactment of rituals that are socially constructed that give the illusion of a gendered essence. So she actually says the opposite. She's saying there is no gender identity. It looks like there is. But the way that it's been taken by her followers, her brood, is a complete misunderstanding, a complete reverse flip on that. But then that's not surprising because everyone who came in the wake of Foucault misunderstood Foucault. You know, now his disciples now are effectively the kind of people who he would probably love to deconstruct, given that everything they play is power games.
Yeah.
You know, but so it is about the inconsistencies and incoherence within the movement that are easily, it falls apart when there's actual scrutiny. And so they have to dress it up with jargon. They have to make it impenetrable to the average intelligent person, because once it becomes impenetrable, it doesn't, it collapses. So that's what if I have a recipe for getting us out of this, it is the promotion of traditional liberal values in tandem with raising awareness of the movement and what it says and what it means.
So you're calling for a jihad of liberal values.
Jihad of liberal values. Exactly. I'm going to get that on a T-shirt.
Yes.
Yeah, and I'll probably be arrested for that, though.
Probably.
I think calling for liberal values, it's a dodgy prospect.
Thank you for coming to Deconstructive Criticism, Andrew Doyle.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to Deconstructive Criticism. This episode's guest was Andrew Doyle. You can buy his books where you buy books, and you can find the link in the description of this episode on my webpage, aaronflam.com. Thank you for supporting Deconstructive Criticism. You can contribute on patreon.com/aaronflam with PayPal, Bitcoin, and on Swish 0046-768-943737. 0046-768-943737. My own book, This is a Swedish Tiger, about how and why social democracy opened the door for Islamists to the West and their inherent Jew hatred, is available on Kindle. I am Aaron Flam. Until you hear from me next, have a good unit of time.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Welcome to Sincerely Sloan, presented by Uninterrupted. I'm your host, professional tennis player, wife, parent, and entrepreneur, Sloan Stevens. As an athlete and as a person, my journey has had a lot of twists and turns, from moments of adversity and doubt to unimaginable triumph and satisfaction. Throughout the season, I'm joined by some of the biggest names in sports, entertainment, culture, and a few members of my tribe. Our conversations keep it real and push it past skin deep. We reveal the perspectives, routines, and products that allow each of us to show up at our best. Join me on my journey of self-discovery and many, many laughs along the way. Sincerely, Sloan.
Ever Googled your own name? Prepare for a shock because your personal info, including addresses and phone numbers, is out there, especially with the recent hacks at some big phone and healthcare companies. But here's where Aura steps in. Aura scans the dark web for your sensitive information and sends real-time alerts. Aura also actively requests that your information be removed from data broker sites, putting you back in control. Aura provides you with a complete online safety toolkit, credit and transaction monitoring, a secure password manager, a privacy-enhancing VPN, and more. Try Aura risk-free with a 14-day trial at aura.com/safety. That's AURA.com/safety. Rest easy with Aura. Visit AURA.com/safety today.